I believe we have a quorum present, and we have a rather full agenda today. But in spite of that, I'm taking the liberty to acknowledge a request of a person who would like to just testify briefly with another little challenge to it. It's not specifically related to the governor's budget, but a challenge to us as an education committee, and we've been accepting challenges all along the way. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Fred Zimmerman to the table. You may recognize his name. He has been writing in the business section of the paper frequently, and I think just not too long ago retired from St. Thomas University.
That's right.
Yeah. Welcome to our committee, Dr. Zimmerman.
Okay, thank you. I won't take a lot of your time. I'm a professor emeritus from St. Thomas. I was a full professor in two schools, engineering and management. There are seven teachers in our family. Most at the university level, some two at the high school level. And we've also had more than 90 foster children. So we've had an opportunity to see kids that are coming from less provided families and what they can accomplish academically if we push them. Now, I know a lot of people in different universities. I've taught in six universities, mostly as a visiting professor. I've taught five times overseas in South America and in Europe. And I have a lot of friends who've done the same thing. And many of us are very alarmed about the quality of education in the United States. The student who would finish in the 50th percentile in the United States on these normalized tests for 8th and 10th grade would finish in the 13th percentile in Singapore. When I was in the Czech Republic, the high school students would take math through differential equations in four languages. In Uruguay, they take three languages. And the average college graduate in Uruguay has about twice as many contact hours in their major field as the United States. But one of the problems that we have in academia is that the high school kids coming in are poorly prepared for any field in science or engineering or math. And my only message here is that I think there's a lot of people in education, both at the K-12 level and at the university level, that would be very pleased if we could do something about weeding out some of the people who are not very conscientious about their job. Our daughter, who was a teacher in southern Minnesota and then later on in the Twin Cities, would complain about teachers in the next door class who didn't do their work, didn't do any homework. We should get rid of some of those people. We should do it in higher education as well. So I have many friends in education. I am in favor of education. But all of the people that I know that are quite dedicated and prominent in the field of education think we should make it into more of a class act than we now have it. And that would involve perhaps trimming it in some way that might help the budget problem or it might not, but it would be good if we could improve the quality and bring into education some people who are more dedicated. So that's all I have to say, Senator. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your taking the trip over here to deliver that message, Dr. Zimmerman. Thank you. Are there any questions that any of you would have of him before we move on? Okay, thank you very much.
Excuse me, Chair?
Yes, Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, and Professor Zimmerman, sorry about the reflections your daughter had to share. I believe the overwhelming majority of educators are very competent and doing the best they can, and I think they want to see the performers not meeting expectation to improve. But I'm curious, in your daughter's case, did she talk to the principal about that?
Yes, there was a lot of discussion at the school. What happened is they yodeled in the broccoli for a very long period of time and then paid the guy to do nothing until he could reach retirement.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? If not, thank you again, Dr. Zimmerman.
Okay. Good luck to you all.
Thank you. We are taking a couple of items from the governor's budget, starting with the Minnesota State Academies.
Madam Chair and committee members, I am Linda Mitchell. I am the superintendent of the Minnesota State Academies. If I may, thank you, first of all, for having us here. We'll give you just a brief snapshot of who we are and what we do. We are a state agency. We are a small state agency made up of two very special and unique schools, one the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind and the other the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. We are located in Faribault, Minnesota. The campuses are about a half a mile apart. We have separate programs and campuses. We do share services of, for example, the maintenance department, the nutrition department, the business office, human services. What's the one I'm forgetting here?
Special ed.
No, there's one more.
Health.
Health services. Thank you. I do have with me, by the way, Billy Ward is the special ed director for the academies. We have been in business for more than 140 years. We were established in 1858 when the state became a state, and then the Civil War happened and nothing happened. So in 1863, the doors were opened, and that was the first year that students were served in the Faribault community. Our students come to us through the IEP process. We are special ed facilities. Our students are deaf or blind or multiply disabled. Right now, and one of the things that we will talk about that the governor is recommending is a trial placement option. Right now, the school districts are the ones who call us, and then the IEP team, the parents, families, school districts, and academy staff agree that the academies is an appropriate placement for a child. And that is, at this point, how students come to us. We are a resource to all of the school districts in the state of Minnesota. If I may, I would like to take a second just to talk about special education federally, how we talk about LRE, which is the least restrictive environment. And in special education, the least restrictive environment is the normal classroom with non-handicapped peers. Unfortunately, the environment becomes more restrictive as you talk about the location of those services. So you could be a child that spends part of their day in a regular classroom. You may be pulled out to a special ed classroom. The next, you may be a child that's in a special ed classroom all day. You may be a child who needs to go to another school to a special program, or you may be a child who needs to go to a residential placement for a special program. In that regard, we're talking about least restrictive being the regular classroom, and because we are an academy's residential option, we are seen as the most restrictive. But when we talk about the needs of our students, and rather than seeing this system of what I call the system of failure, where you start out in a regular classroom, and if you can't do that, then you might be pulled out for special assistance. And if you can't do that, you might go to a special classroom. And so there's this top-down kind of from least restrictive to most restrictive. What we would like to be seen as is that continuum of services that really goes from left to right. That for our kids, the least restrictive environment, and I'll use as an example first a deaf child, where our staff all have required sign language levels that they have to meet, which means that a child has direct communication access with their teachers, with the aides, with the people in the kitchen, the people in the dorm, whatever area of the campus that they are in. For them, it is that access to communication that in that environment is the least restrictive. So rather than having to go through an interpreter, and if you're in a classroom, I can interpret math, but when you go out to your locker and then you go to lunch and then you go somewhere else, you are literally on your own unless you have that interpreter with you. So in that regard, we do feel that our students in that setting are more restricted than they may be with us. Now, for blind students, a little bit different. Blind students in a public school setting, actually, with the right assistive technology, whether it's Braille, whether it's a screen reader for their computer, they can do pretty well. They can do pretty well in the classroom. The challenges for them become a little bit more related to how they navigate the world. You know, they may not be able to get from here to the gymnasium or from here to downtown, but they can actually do the classroom work fairly well. What we see is that many of those kids need the related services of orientation and mobility. They may need to learn to read Braille. But kids who come to us don't have to stay with us for 12 years. They may come to us, acquire those specialized services, and then be able to go back to their public school setting and do very well. So rather than being seen as down here and this is you're the bottom and you're never going to get out of there, we would prefer to be seen as an option that a child might need for a while, but then they would be able to go back to another setting with the proper skills. Having said that, we serve children from birth to 21, the regular special ed, 0 to 21. And we have seen a change with the newborn infant screening that is required in Minnesota. There are about 100 babies who are identified every year. Now, again, they're identified. That doesn't mean that all 100 are kids who are deaf and stay deaf. They may not pass the test the first time, but they may pass it the second or third time. 2 years ago, we started, again, our early childhood program, and we started with, I think there were 4 kids in the area and 2 babies. And this year we've got 22 students in the classrooms and probably another 5 to 10 babies that are out there that we serve. So we see students who are families who move to the area so that they can access our services. We also have transition services for both groups of students. And again, this may be more of a transition program for a blind student who may do their high school coursework and be ready to go on, but aren't ready to go out and try and figure out how to navigate a college campus. They may not know how to do their laundry. They may not know how to cook. But those are skills that they can pick up during that 18 to 21 transition time and then go on to college and higher education and be successful. Having said that, I'll ask if there are any questions before we go to the...
Do members have any questions? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious if you could explain, is the maintenance of effort affect the budget side, or does it affect both the budget and the service that's delivered?
And I think to answer that, I think it affects the budget side. I don't think it affects the services that we deliver. And I do have to say, I didn't talk a lot about my own background, but I've been at the academies for 30 years, and I sort of feel bad after a while when I think that every year I come up and tell you that our kids are more complicated than ever. And honest to God, they are more complicated than ever. But I can look back at the time when we used to say things that, oh, that's just the way deaf kids behave. That's how they explore their environment, whatever. Now I have to tell you that, if anything, I really commend the work of our professionals who can tell you this is a deaf child on the autism spectrum. This is a deaf child with a learning disability. This is a deaf child that, you know, has EBD problems. We can recognize those things now. So in that regard, I think we're serving them better. I also have to say that I think for the kids that can mainstream, that we've gotten better at that as well. I think there are a number of the kids that we don't see at the academies anymore who are out in the mainstream. Their hearing loss, there may be more hard of hearing kids who are able to function in a mainstream environment. On the other hand, we are also seeing kids who are multiply disabled who require, you know, whether it's because we are keeping preemies alive longer, whether it's because we have children with traumatic brain injuries or cancer. There are a variety of reasons that what we see has gotten much more complicated. So in terms of maintenance of effort, you know, we do have to fill out the same things that, yeah, we're spending this much. But having said that, as our kids get more complicated, that hasn't really impacted us in a great way.
Is it Dr. Mitchell?
No.
Okay, Ms. Mitchell. You're Superintendent Mitchell. Can you just give us a brief, we haven't got the bill before us, but can you give us a brief description of the proposal about the trial, trial attendance?
Yes.
And then you may want to say a few words about the budget recommendation.
Sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this issue for the trial placement really has come about with work that we have done with MASE, the special ed directors in the state. We had this bill ready to go last year, and I believe it would have passed it had it been a part of an education bill. But having said that, for a variety of reasons, the current situation is that the school districts pretty much are the ones who make a recommendation for a child to come to the academies. There are districts in the state who have used our services for years. There are districts in the state who have not. I can tell you as an example that we have had parents and families who moved to Minnesota from out of state, and I have actually gotten phone calls from parents who say, okay, where do we need to move so that our kids can go to the academies? They want to know if there's a school district that is friendly to allowing kids to attend, and then they'll move there. And my response to them, quite honestly, was, well, the only one that I know for sure is Faribault, Minnesota, because if they live in the Faribault district, it's an automatic that they can choose to come there. But having said that, there are a variety of reasons that school districts may or may not want a child to come to the academies, and I kind of walk a fine line here because, quite honestly, we work with them all the time, and I do understand what some of those issues are. For both blind and deaf children, these are low-incidence disabilities. So, you know, there may be a small rural school district that has a teacher because you have a blind child. If you don't have that child, that person doesn't have a job. Now, I'm not saying that that is always what happens, but those are issues that may drive a determination as to whether or not a child should come to the academies. On the other side of the scale, there is the very large school district that says, you know, we already have our own program for deaf kids. Your child can be part of our program. We don't think they need the academies. Now, we just would like there to be some kind of balance here with allowing parents the option to be able to, if it's an appropriate placement, and again, this would still be a conversation, that if they meet criteria for deafness or for blindness, that they have the opportunity to do that. Years ago, there were not so many options in the world. Now there are many, and I would say that the academies is one of the many that is an appropriate option. It may not be for 12 years of a child's life. It may not be forever, but it may be an appropriate placement for a period of time. As an example, we had a family who a couple of years ago really, really, really wanted their son at the academies. There was quite a bit of resistance from the school district, and right now the only recourse that parents have is to go through the conciliation, mediation process of due process of special ed. After 2 years, the young man did come to us. He spent 2 years with us and quite honestly was very successful and is now back in his home district, and he's doing fine. So I think that is the kind of thing we would like to see as an opportunity and an option for parents to make it a little bit fair for them to have some say in their child's education.
Ms. Mitchell, the school district of residence still has to pay foot the bill, special ed bill. Is that part of the issue then that might be make this a bit challenging in terms of the proposal for this trial placement? And is there a limitation on the length of that trial placement?
Yes, Madam Chair. First of all, the trial placement is a 60 to 90 day trial placement. One of the things that we really want to be a resource to the school districts in the state, so our attempt is...
We've got a heavy agenda, so if you could just kind of keep it focused on that rather than... Because we will be hearing the bill, too.
Yes.
But it's
yes.
a trial placement, and it's and the local district does...
The local district...
Has to pay the bill.
And again, this... This cost for the 60 to 90 days is not going to be the $5,000 annual cost.
Okay.
Now, if the child stays there, that is the tuition cost for a child to attend the academies. We're trying to be as cost neutral as possible, and what ends up being an issue for us is that even in our statute language, it says tuition. What is not clearly identified in that language is that the basic aid revenue for the per pupil cost is what the school district pays. They get to keep the they still get to count the kids for the levies. They get the compensatory ed monies. So really what they're giving up for the year, for the school year, is that $5,000 cost. The fraction of that, if it was the 90 days, would obviously be much less.
So it's prorated for that,
right.
that time. Now, is that reflected in the budget figures? Could you just give a brief discussion of the budget proposal of the governor?
And the budget figures here do turn out to show a net cost to the state, but I think that... The only way to explain that, and I may not be the expert here, if people have questions, we may have to ask MDE's fiscal expert to explain it. But
well, maybe would you like Mr. Nauman to do that?
Well, I was just going to say that our reimbursement rate is what changes. That if there are more students at the academies, our enrollment number, we get a larger increase in terms of the special ed reimbursement rate. So that's where the cost would come from.
So, Mr. Nauman, you want to?
Madam Chair and members, as I understand the calculation that the department did on this is that there isn't a dollar-for-dollar swap when a kid is subtracted from a school and goes to the academies. There's a ratio calculation that is done when a student goes to the academies. The assumption is made that there will be some increase of students as a result of the trial placement recommendation that will generate a $4,000 and $13,000 cost in the 12 and 13 biennium. This is statewide. And then $26,000 each year in 14 and 15. So it's not a large dollar figure, but there is a cost. And parenthetically, this was a cost item that was missed in the fund balance when the governor's recommendation came out, so it's not carried in the fund balance. We are showing it in the Senate's fiscal tracking.
Okay, thank you. And any other comments you'd like to make on the general budget for your for the academies? There is some reduction that you are being asked to.
Yes.
Yep. Could you just explain that
I can
briefly.
Certainly explain that as well. One of the things, and I do want to acknowledge that we certainly recognize the fiscal challenges that our state is making, and we have been racking our brains as well trying to figure out ways that we can do business more efficiently and still provide services to our students. One of the things that we wanted to do, of course, was to keep these cuts away from the classroom and the education of our kids. This happens to be a way for us to change how we're delivering nutrition services to our students. We believe we can do it as well nutritionally. We can do it without causing any negative kind of nutritional problem for our students and save money. We are probably one of the few state agencies that was preparing food on site for our students. Part of the reason that this works very successfully for us now is that of our 12, 13, 14 staff that we had, the majority of those folks took advantage of the early retirement incentive this year. And so we will be able to change how we do business without paying unemployment costs and being able to, again, serve our students at the same level and quality as we have been in the past.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair,
actually, I do have one question.
Senator Thompson.
Relating to the Purpich School in particular, what is the cost per pupil there?
The Purpich School is coming up.
That's next.
This is the State Academy.
Okay, so. I thought she was dealing with both those issues.
No.
Okay, all right.
Okay, next is the Purpich Center for Arts Education. Welcome to the Senate Education Committee.
Good afternoon.
You introduce yourself for the record. And
my name is Sue Mackard, and I'm proud to serve as Executive Director of the Purpich Center for Arts Education. I'm here today to respond to the Governor's proposed budget for the Purpich Center for Arts Education. And joining me are Senior Director of Policy, Dr. Pamela Paulson, and Grand Meadow School Principal Paul Bezo, who can give some ideas to why we support this budget. The governor has recommended that funding for Purpich remain at current levels of $7 million per year. No reductions are proposed. We support this position, and I need to just give you a little bit of information as to why we support this position. Achievement gaps, together with declining or elimination of art programs in schools, have generated greater demand today for services of the Purpich Center than in any other time in the agency's history. 88% of school districts, representing 91% of the state's student population, have indicated desire for services from the Purpich Center. Last year, we had the capacity to serve 85 of Minnesota's 342 school districts, reaching 13,000 teachers responsible for 220,000 students. We leveraged our expertise and delivered these services at a cost of about $1.36 per student, and we know that we will do better. In research commissioned as a means to hold us accountable, 78% of the responders in an external survey said that the Purpich Center programs were more effective than other professional development opportunities for which they had been exposed. 88% of respondents cited our professionalism and our expertise as our strongest attributes. These numbers are vital. We've learned where we inspire and support teachers and administrators in breaking paradigms, changing teaching methods, incorporating best practices, and supporting a culture of assessment and accountability, that they are successful in addressing the systemic issues affecting student achievement. Statewide, the Arts High School residential school serves urban and rural 11th and 12th grade students, and it acts as a laboratory for us for innovation. So whether students apply at the Arts High School because of their academic or artistic ability, or because they aren't able to respond to academic programs in their local schools because of their creative minds, perhaps, they are expected when they arrive to achieve. Classes begin at 8 and end at 4:15. The academic building is open in the evening, and the library has shifted hours this year in order to remain open two nights per week. Our standards call for 100% graduation, including those students on IEPs or in special education. We also expect 100% college placement for those desiring post-secondary education. And as some of you know from previous work with the Purpich Center, our students annually attract about $4 million in scholarships. Last week, the College Board, who we consider to be a strong partner in educational assessment and testing, presented the Purpich Center with their inaugural award for excellence and innovation in arts education. The College Board's been exploring education that is focused in and through the arts, and they've concluded that incorporation of arts education does, in fact, have a net positive effect on student achievement. So, accept flat funding? Yes. We understand, too, that the economic situation in the state is dire, and we can do our part by further stretching and leveraging those resources for the betterment of education. We will succeed because we promote a culture of best practices in teaching, so too in how we operate as a state agency, re-engineering our operational systems and pushing performance indicators as we employ valuable taxpayer dollars that build investment in Minnesota's youth. We know that integrating the arts in education will enable Minnesota students to excel. And we will be there working in partnership, district to district, as they make difficult decisions, teacher to teacher, and student to student. We are poised and able to continue our heritage of excellence in the art of education. I would now like to ask Dr. Paulson to share briefly a glimpse of the growing value of creativity in arts education.
Dr. Paulson.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Pam Paulson, and I serve as the Senior Director of Policy at the Purpit Center for Arts Education. And as you heard Sue describe, the Purpit Center is a dynamic education center, and it's an interesting time for us because we're seeing kind of a triangle of effects happening where, as she mentioned, 88% of the school districts have said they would like assistance from us, so there's demand at one of those corners. And in the second corner, we know that schools are being faced with serious budget problems, and so there are declining resources in school districts. And then the third corner is the fact that we have high-quality programs that we can stretch, as Sue said, in order to extend these high-quality programs without additional dollars. The Purpit Center is really dedicated to teaching and learning, and we want to help teachers become better teachers because research shows that the most important factor affecting student achievement is the teacher in the classroom. And each of you on this committee has students from your legislative district currently attending our arts high school. All of you but one have had teachers from your legislative district attend professional development programs that the Purpit Center has offered this year. So we are really trying to get out there and be useful to the schools and the teachers. When we started the Purpit Center 25 years ago, we knew that the students that we accepted into the high school, as well as the students around the state that get opportunities in the arts because of the Purpit Center, would not all be artists. In fact, we guessed at that time that at least 60% would not. We knew that they would go into different careers and professions, and we've had students go to MIT. They become engineers. We've had students become lawyers and architects, even state of Minnesota employees, educators, technology wizards, and we currently have one that's a military chaplain. The Partnership for 21st Century Skills, who I'm sure that most of you are familiar with, includes some of our most enormous corporations in our country, Adobe and Apple and Cisco and Dell, ETS and Hewlett, Intel, Microsoft, Oracle, Verizon, and even Walt Disney. These business people, thinking about the future economy, list three skills that they believe are important for learning and innovation. The first one is creativity and innovation. The second one is critical thinking and problem solving. And the third one is communication collaboration. Just last month, a new survey by IBM was released. They asked 1,500 CEOs of some of the world's major companies what they thought would be the most important leadership quality in the next 5 years. And guess what they said? 60% said creativity. One of those IBM managers said that this was really a very surprising finding because coming off of the worst economic times they've ever seen, these CEOs did not fall back on management or current practices or operations. Instead, they looked forward for creative solutions to problems. couple of years before that, the Conference Board did a study of school superintendents and CEOs and found that over 96% said creativity was of increasing importance to the U.S. workforce. So there are many good reasons to include the arts in the curriculum. They help students develop focus, discipline, persistence, but one of the things they really do is help develop creativity in students. And to close my comments, when Ernst & Young released their 2010 Connecting Innovation to Profit report, it really gave us a wake-up call when they said, we assume that 50% of our revenue in the next 5 years' time must come from sources that do not exist today. That is why we must innovate. Ernst & Young also found that highly successful companies realize that the ability to manage, organize, cultivate, and nurture creative thinking is directly connected to growth and achievement. So the Perpich Center would like to continue helping prepare students and teachers all across our state with these 21st century skills that will be critical to their achievement and to our economic future. So you can hear firsthand about how Perpich Center programs have had an impact on schools directly. We have a recipient of some of the Perpich Center programming and services to tell you a very brief story about his school. So I'd like to turn it over to Paul Basil, principal at Grand Meadow High School.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the Senate Education Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Say your name and connection yourself so it gets
Paul
on the
Basil,
tape.
Grand Meadow principal.
Thank you.
Once again, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. Just some quick background. I have worked with Perpich Center in their outreach program for over 6 years in three different districts. So I've worked with them in the Austin Public Schools, the Worthington Public Schools, and now currently in Grand Meadow. So I'm going to take you through a little bit of a journey on each of those schools and what the Perpich Center has meant to us in the Out County school districts. In the Austin School District, we were fortunate to get a grant, and what we found out, Austin is a fairly good sized town. It's got a Fortune 500 company in it with Hormel, and we do have some pretty quality educational opportunities in the schools through the arts, orchestra, band, choir. But there's also many things going on in the community as well. But the problem was there wasn't a central location for people to know where to look for those things. And so the CAP grant in the Austin Public Schools and the community created awareness of what's happening in town. What can we go see? Is it going to be at the college? Is it going to be at the high school? Is it going to be at the Paramount Theater, which has been rejuvenated at that point in time? So that's what the main emphasis was in Austin. Now, Worthington is becoming a much more diverse community based upon the different ethnicities that have moved into the community. I was the elementary principal there for 3 years, and Prairie Elementary has 1,100 students in it and K-5. And we moved the fifth grade over to the middle school so we could get a little bit more room, and they're back up to 1,000 kids. So Worthington is a growing community. Once again, I brought it to the attention of the arts and music department, said, hey, there's a place up in Golden Valley that has an opportunity that we can write some grants for, or write a grant to bring awareness. And they're going, okay, what are you thinking about? You know, another principal bringing in a great idea and going to back out. But what happened was it unified the music and the art staff. They wrote the grant, successfully received it, but then the more people we brought into the committee, we ended up with over 35 people just on the main committee. Our meetings lasted hours because there's too many people. So what we eventually did is created subcommittees to focus our attention on it. And what they found out was that we were missing dance. The dance, as you remember in middle school or high school or elementary, was the schottische and the waltz and all those things that we, you know, had to dance with a girl, or girls had to dance with the guys, during Phi Ed or whatever it might be. We found out that had died away. It wasn't being taught anymore. And then with the diversity that was coming into the community, we were finding out that the new kids and the new families coming to town didn't really know much about American dance, and we didn't know much about their cultural dance. And we found out that was the common conduit. So they went ahead and wrote up standards, that included dance. And I just got an email back from Worthington just yesterday that they have brought in a 10-day residence, an artisan residence, to focus on folklore dance and different dances of all the different ethnicities that currently go into Worthington for 10 days in grades 4 and 8. So that's pretty cool. But that's just the grant piece. Their outreach program also came down to Worthington and worked on aligning our standards to the national music standards. So they are currently on top of what everything they need to do. They've scaffolded their curriculum all the way from early childhood all the way through 12th grade so that the students are all getting the things that they need in the area of music education. And lastly, I've been in Grand Meadow since July, and once again, I'm in a different size school. My school is K-12, approximately 380 students. And we are on our own. We only have vocal music. We don't have band. We don't have orchestra. But we have a need. We share a superintendent with two other districts. So our superintendent, Reshetar, oversees three school districts. And what that has taught us a lot about is how to collaborate and cooperate, share resources, and we have now shared resources in the area of staff development. And so you're looking at a principal who has one fifth grade teacher, one sixth grade teacher, and I had 9 or 10 kindergarten sections in one building and so forth. The teachers are on their own. They're on an island. But our staff development opportunities have created so that we can all get together at certain times. We have a common calendar. So one of the discussions that we had is, well, what can we do to increase our art awareness, our music awareness? And so now they're currently in the process of writing another CAP grant. And by the way, CAP stands for Comprehensive Arts Planning Program. And that is part of the outreach program from the Purpich Center. And in each of the areas that I've been involved in as an administrator, they have gone ahead and been extremely professional. They've really helped us focus and narrow down our approach to educating kids in the arts, and they've expanded things. Right now, they were talking about just a few things they want to do. I said, no, Purpich wants you to think bigger. Well, how do you know? I said, well, I know them. No, think bigger. I mean, three times I had to say, think bigger. And here's what they're thinking about doing. In each of these communities, Grand Meadow, Lyle, Leroy, South and Adams, Glenville Emmons, they're looking at potentially taking some of the storefronts in these main streets, which are so prominent around the state that are closing down, and trying to talk to the owners and say, can we put an art studio in your main street building so our kids can display their work? That's what Purpich does. They force you to think out of the box. They force you to think bigger, and they're there to support you once you decide that you can do that. And they can help you whether or not, if it's real or not. But it doesn't matter if it's real or not, because they're there to support you. So in closing, I want to read just something to you. The Purpich Center, the employees, and the CAP grant program have helped many educators and community people create common goals and missions which have enhanced the awareness of the arts. They are an essential program which help urban and rural communities make connections with the arts in a time when many of these types of programs are being reduced or cut due to budget constraints. As an educator and an administrator who has worked with Purpich Center in small, medium, and large school districts, the results of working with the people at the Purpich Center has always been the same. Quality, intellectual, collaborative advocates for making solid decisions which enhance the educational opportunities for all students and building better community awareness and appreciation for all the arts areas of the arts. Lastly, these few words I'd like to leave you with that describe the Purpich Center, the people that work there, and what they do for all kids in the state of Minnesota. Collaboration, they simplify the tough stuff, they're understanding, they're educated, they're patient, they clarify, they're very organized, they're very fiscally responsible, they're advocates, they're challengers, they're passionate, they're knowledgeable, and they're committed. And I've gone ahead and summated a little bit of my presentation in a letter that I'd like to hand to each of you so that you have something to fall back on after our presentation, if that's okay.
I think Paige will distribute that for you if you want to give it to her when she comes. Are there any questions that members have? There you go.
No,
Senator Thompson.
What is the cost per pupil per year at the Purpich Center?
Madam Chair.
Ms. McCurdy.
Senator Thompson, I'm very glad you asked that question. The per pupil cost is $9,200 approximately, and that's down from double digits of a few years ago, and again, because of re-engineering and focusing and and putting our resources where they are most needed.
Senator Nino.
Is that per pupil cost, is that cost associated with the individual student and these other services are segregated aside in separate costs, or is that included? I wasn't clear in that in your answer.
Madam Chair.
Ms. McGurden.
Senator, I'm very glad you asked for that clarification, because we generally do not operate on a per pupil cost. Internally, we know what things cost, but we are not funded at per pupil at all. We are funded lump sum, and then it's governed by our board of directors and our staff to determine how best to use those funds. So it is, when we look at per pupil, that is basically per student our costs, but the full budget is dispersed and varies in accordance to our strategic plan and goals. Does that answer your question?
Can I help you with that for a minute? The center operates a high school, but you've also been a resource center. And I'm assuming that the resource center is where the outreach and working with staff development in the districts around the state. Is the number that you gave us for the operation of the high school, or are you adding all of the money and spreading it around to the resource, to the schools, districts that you have been effectively describing?
Madam Chair, the figure that I gave you would be just simply for the school, the operation of the school, and the students that attend the Arts High School.
And Madam Chair, what proportion would you say goes to each? What is the amount that, or the proportion that you have available to you for the resource role that you play for arts education around the state?
The Madam Chair,
Ms.
the
Eckerton.
outreach portion combined with our library that we also consider outreach because it's accessible to all outstate educators, would make up the bulk of those funds along with administration and dorm fees. So that would be an additional approximately a little more than $4,500,000. The Madam Chair, if I could also explain that we do not include our dorm costs in the per pupil costs.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, that was my follow-up. I was going to say, you've got them living on campus, and it's costing the same per pupil roughly as other students in Minnesota. Is the total per pupil cost per year? Not. I'm not looking for any one individual element of it.
Ms. McGurden.
Senator Olson, Senator Thompson, the total per pupil cost, you're asking me to add the residence hall in that, are you?
I guess everything, Madam Chair, everything that goes into having a student at the
high school,
at the Purpose Center in a year.
Okay.
Ms. McGurden.
Thompson, if I understand your question correctly, it is for the Arts High School, a per pupil cost for students attending the Arts High School and those residing in the dorm. We have approximately half of our students that reside in the dorm. The dorm costs are approximately $6,200 room and board, and that would be added to 128 of those students on per pupil. We do offset those costs, and we set a figure taking the median income level, which is about $3,400 for our students, and that's what parents and students are asked to pay for their dorm costs. So we subsidize that amount by approximately, for students on financial aid and those on free and reduced, we subsidize that by almost half of the dorm costs. But it's kind of hard to separate or to add the full per pupil cost on all students. For those that live in the dorm and have room and board, the cost would be approximately $15,000 per pupil.
Thank you. Okay. Are there further questions? Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, this isn't exactly on track, but I think it's important. How are the what shape are the facilities in there? Are they in good repair and or do they need a lot of maintenance?
Senator Olson, Senator Stump, our facilities need work. In the last session, we requested and we were granted funds to take care of just those issues that dealt with the most hazardous health and safety issues, new windows in the dorm, the demolition of a building that was unsafe, and construction of a storage facility. We know that long-term, aside from just normal maintenance and upkeep, we have a dock, for example, that needs to be repaired. It is no longer functional for deliveries. We have some normal, we're at the lowest point in Golden Valley, so we flood. We flood every year, and that's something that we need to consider that's going to take some work. And then, of course, we have our normal wish list like other schools, and, of course, we don't levy for this, but we don't have a facility within the organization where we can fit all students. And so there are things like that are later on the list and that I'm hoping would be of private-public partnership. They certainly won't come before the legislature while the budget is in the condition it is.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we had a committee hearing at the Perpich a couple years ago, I think Senator Wieger's committee, and so it was very interesting to go out and tour the grounds and very impressive what you're doing there. You mentioned that you have this commitment for 100% graduation as well as 100% college bound. How are you doing against those two goals?
Ms. Mackerton.
Chair. Senator Bonoff, thank you so much for allowing me to brag and respond to that question. We're doing quite well. And last year, one student didn't graduate. He has since then, but didn't meet standards and couldn't go through graduation. We work very hard to make certain we are reaching students because, like every school, we have IEP, we have students with autism, we have students with cerebral palsy, and every single one of them must be reached. And so we're doing quite well in both graduation rates and those that go on to college. And that's very critical for us, and that one of the things that we're seeing more of are parents that are discouraging their young people from going to college because they're afraid of the cost. Now, part of that is that Perpich students do get good grants, and they are sought after by schools across the country. But I have been working very heavily with our strong and very good community college system, as we have some students whose parents, especially some of the first-time college family students, are having difficulty thinking of college. So we are working with the community colleges and have placed quite a few in a couple of schools that have accredited arts programs. So thank you. I look forward to reporting after this graduation, our 20th class.
Senator Stump?
Madam Chair, it might be good to mention that, and I either was not paying attention or I missed it. The component probably has the most meaning for Greater Minnesota isn't so much the art school itself, but it's the training and the connection that you have with school districts around the state. And I know Principal Zimmerman mentioned it.
Basil.
I'm sorry. But it was that has been very impressive, I think, and has been very effective in many districts to bring the arts to those local communities. And that's, I think, something that makes it very worthwhile across the state.
Madam Chair, may I respond to
yes,
that?
Yes, Dr. Paulson.
Senator Olson actually helped us do a better job at reaching into rural Minnesota, as Senator Stump is suggesting, when she sponsored a bill early on in the existence of the Perpich Center to create what was at that time called magnet schools. and they are in the various congressional districts. We have four of them right now: Albert Lea, Thief River Falls, Westbrook, Walnut Grove, and Elk River. So those are sites where resources go to the regions to help students who don't want to leave their homes get solid, good arts experiences near their homes. We have many other programs as well, but that's one that I wanted to mention for sure.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, thank you. According to the data that I just received here, we had 286 students at the school and a $6.891 million general fund appropriation. And then over and above that, I understand that parents may make some contribution. I don't know if there's federal funds involved or not, but possibly. But even if you just look at this general fund, it's $24,000 per year per student if you do the math from the general fund. Now, I understand you do outreach as well as teach. What's the breakdown there? What's going out into the community? Dollar-wise as compared to staying in the institution for teaching and room and board and the like? Because with the parent contribution, we're up north of $25,000 per year per student.
Ms. McCracken, that was what I was trying to get at with my early questions. I think you did give us the numbers of the actual dollars per pupil. So if you could subtract that, what is the dollar amount that actually goes for the what we had? It has at least originally was labeled, and I don't know if that has been changed, as the resource center aspect of your role, and serves the both what Principal Basil as well as Senator Stump has been referring to.
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, I will abdicate to my financial manager to provide that information, if you would. And his name is Mike Zabel.
Mr. Zabel, just say your name for the record. And
Mike Zabel, I'm the financial manager at the Purpose Center for Arts Education.
Thank you.
The question was regarding the general fund appropriation. Our general fund appropriation is $7,087,000 annually. In that breakdown, PDR, or the outreach area, is given $1.7 million for outreach and staff cost. The Arts High School is given directly $2.8 million to cover the costs of schooling. We have the rest goes to various areas within, like we have the library, for example, and then we have the administration of the agency and the maintenance and upkeep of the building itself. So it's kind of hard to quantify the per pupil cost for our center because we don't get funded that way, and so we don't really have a good avenue to determine those numbers.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Could
point
you
point of clarification, Senator Olson?
Yes.
That I think
would
be important for. What
did you sit down and talk into the mic? Thank you,
Chairperson Olson and Senator Thompson. A point of clarification: that one of the reasons it's difficult to separate those numbers is that our arts high school faculty are required to also provide outreach services. So a portion of their salary that comes from the Arts High School is also dedicated to outreach services. And more as schools, districts such as those represented by Mr. Basil come forward, then we, in fact, send our teachers out to. And that's why it's not the cleanest cut on pricing.
And
thank you.
Any other further questions? Otherwise, Ms. McCracken, I wish you or Dr. Paulson could address another area that I'll spring on you. I know we've got some bills to do, so we want to move on, but if you could just briefly, we did, through our Arts Education Subcommittee relative to the legacy funds, did make an appeal and had some inclusion for the Purpose Center to do some special work in terms of integration of arts in areas where they may not have regular arts programs. Could you tell us, just give us an idea, both the amount that you received and where you are in progress in the development of that?
Madam Chair, committee members, We did receive $1 million from the Legacy Fund. It was divided by $300,000 in the first year and $700,000 in the second year. We used some portion of that first year to do a statewide study on the status of arts education that has never been done in our state before, to a degree where we were really trying to figure out, are the schools even teaching the standards? Which standards are they trying to teach? Are they assessing kids? And what accountability do we have for the tax dollars that are going to schools because we don't have a statewide accountability system in the arts? So the other part of the money was used for an arts integration project in the Lakes Country, which is the way far western middle of the state counties. We have 9 schools that are working with us in that arts integration project. They are Holly, Lake Park Audubon, Moorhead, Morris, New York Mills, Osakis, Wind Middle School, that was Perham, Rothsay, and Wheaton. Some of those schools are very small and are K-12 in one building, and some are larger. They have teams of teachers that are across all the subject areas. Some teach math, some social studies, business, psychology, and they're hooking up with their colleagues in the arts to create integrated lessons that are much more engaging for the students, but they're all tied to the subject area standards, regardless of whichever subject area is being included in the arts integration project.
Thank you. We will be later. I've requested that we have an opportunity to meet with the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, which is conflicts with our time. When they get to, they have the authority over the legacy funds. And so when arts education is a part of that discussion, and those entities that are involved with that, we will be able to engage in that discussion together with them. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can I just ask one question?
Yes, Senator Nelson, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to ignore you.
Oh, that's okay. Just quickly, I think a real important piece, it was mentioned that as far as outstate Minnesota, one of the reaches that you have is the, I don't know, I'd call it staff development or taking arts out into the classroom and with the teachers. And the only number I recall hearing was the either 88 or 91% of districts have asked for that. For those services. I'm just wondering if you have any records of, you know, either how many days of in-service you provided or how many teachers were affected or were given instruction. You might not have that right today, but I think that's an important thing that I would really like to get a handle on. Really, how are you impacting the schools out state, and how are you helping them, especially in times of budget challenges, address the need for art education? So anything you can get me on that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Who am I?
Madam Chair.
Oh, say, Senator Doris Ray.
Thank you. Just wanted to point out that in this book that we receive, there is that information is available, Senator Nelson, and there is at a glance very good chart that talks about the services that you provide. It talks about 260 teachers in the library, 2,400 students across Minnesota, 13,000 teachers, administrators across the state. So I think that's here. And Madam Chair, I just wanted to make a comment because I think that Senator Thompson makes, I've been trying to work with some numbers in the Minneapolis School District about, you know, dividing this pie. And imagine, and Mr. Neumann has been trying to help me figure this out with the different formulas. And when you talk about $760 million and 32,000 students, multiply this, you know, I don't know how to put this number. 25 times. And I think that this points to our responsibility and perhaps an opportunity for us to talk about how do we help the different districts and the centers kind of manage, and not manage, but guide your process of helping us understand how this funding actually works. Because I think it is possible, but I don't think that we have really put time and effort into figuring out how these dollars kind of follow the kid. And for those of us who serve districts that are quite large, we just get very confused, and these questions are very legitimate. You know, if we have, you know, this big number and then we have this number of kids, we just divide the number and, you know, that amounts to 25, 20,000, whatever it is. And in Minneapolis, the number is kind of the same, you know, about 25,000. but I get the answer. It's not that simple. It depends on who the kid is. It depends on what program. It depends on what age. So many factors. So I hope that we are able to dive into that conversation in the future, Madam Chair.
I'm sure we're going to have that opportunity as we get, get rolling on budgets. Thank you very much. This has been very helpful.
Thank you, Chair Olson and committee members.
Thanks for all you're doing. And we have some bills here that Senator Daley sent a file 209. Senator Bonhoeff, would you like to join him? I gave your... You've got the same subject, so.
Madam Chair, I'm State Senator Ted Daley.
Madam Chair, members.
Minnesota Statute 127A.46 permits the state to delay payments to school districts within a fiscal year, and if it would reduce the need for the state to short-term borrow. This legislation that I'm proposing, Senate File 209, would repeal this authority. While I'm interested in protecting the cash flow position of the state, I do not believe it makes sense to do so by jeopardizing the cash flow situation of the local school districts and forcing them to possibly short-term borrow. When we delay payments to school districts, we are only passing the buck, or in this case, keeping the buck. Approximately $192 million away from our local schools. The difficulties at the state level have been a result of building in too much spending and not having an adequate reserve to weather the ups and downs of the revenue and expenditure cycles. We already have school districts dealing with an unprecedented payment shift that provides only 70% of the state aid they are eligible to receive in the current year. The remaining 30% is not paid until the next fiscal year. To then delay when school districts receive their 70% payment is just further piling on, and I don't think we should do this. Senator Stumpf, I think you may be interested to know there's not only no fiscal note, but there's no fiscal impact, although there is there's a financial impact, of course, to both the state and the school districts. Members, I draw your attention to this big, long sheet here, if you could pull that out, if you've got that in your packet, just to draw your attention to a specific example to illustrate the issue. If you look on the second line, it says Minneapolis Public School District. I'll give you a second to find that. In the second... The third column, the UFAR's unappropriated fund balance, it says $107 million. So this is their fund balance. This is the money they've got. And if you look over to the column titled Aid Delay 130, as in January 30th, 2011, you'll see $13.1 million in that column. So while they do have a fund balance, or because they do have a fund balance, we're delaying payment to them to the tune of $13.1 million. So it definitely has an impact on Bernadia Johnson and what she's trying to do with the Minneapolis School District to manage her finances. So right now we're saying to local school districts, we're going to use your cash reserve because we're having troubles with our cash flow. So bottom line, I urge you to support Senate File 209 to protect our local school districts.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I carried this bill last year along with the chairwoman, Senator Olson, so I know that you share our concern about this. But just for members' background information, this was done in the 80s when there were similar cash flow challenges. The legislature, after it got through a very contentious session where they were concerned about the bond rating of the state, decided that the one solution would be to put a provision in law that directed the Commissioner of Revenue, before they could short-term borrow, insisted that they take the money right from school districts' reserves. So we last year, that came to our attention because, in fact, we discovered we were going to be in the red when it came to cash flow needs. And so last year, what we were able to do through negotiation is, rather than just repeal it, even though that's what a couple of us wanted to do, we were able to change it to the commissioner may borrow from the schools and then put a cap on it. And the only time you could borrow from the school district's reserves is if a school district had more than $700 per pupil in their reserves. So that limited the amount of districts that we could have borrowed from. But in the figures that Senator Daley mentioned, actually, like, for example, the Minneapolis figure, that didn't include the second time we borrowed. And so, in fact, for Minneapolis, we're now into Minneapolis $35 million, not just the original 13. And I have a list of the members around this table who are affected. Senator Nelson, Rochester is owed $2.9 million. Senator Stumpf, Grigla is owed $1 million. Senator Chamberlain, $1.2 million for White Bear Lake. Senator Wolf, Mounds View, is owed $165,000. Senator Torsley, I mentioned the $35 million. Senator Sieben, $11.7 million to Hastings. Senator Nenow, Cambridge-Asante, $2.3 million. Senator Han, they were owed, they're paid back. Senator DeCroof, Northfield, $1.1 million. So, you know, I know that the districts that we all represent are concerned about this, and it seems to me that we should not use our school districts as a bank, in essence, for the financial management issues that our state is facing. With regard to the AAA rating, when they started doing this practice, there actually was an alert put out about the state of Minnesota. I don't think they downgraded our rating, but it's not like this isn't seen from the financial sector. So I don't think we're doing ourselves any favors by using this tactic. So,
may I just ask a question of Mr. Nauman? Because the last year the law said that you had to, and it was at $350. They did have to borrow, but the executive branch did take the liberty, because of it had been so long, they moved it up to $700 in what dollars per pupil that were exempt from the borrowing for the fund balance. And it was also done, I think, late in the year of it. Was it March or April when they borrowed? So the law says it has to be paid back by May 30th. But I believe this year the need was earlier, so they've borrowed, and it's for a longer period of time. But I kind of missed this jump from the 13 to the $35 million. Could you explain that?
Madam Chair and members, I'll do my best. There's a lot of moving pieces here in this particular piece of public policy, and I think perhaps with your permission, it's worth clarifying that this is not the payment shift. This is an inter-year, it's within a single year. So the school districts don't lose any money in any particular year as a result of this policy. It's just we're moving off the normal 23 times per year payment schedule. Districts get paid 23 times during the course of the year. It's roughly every 2 weeks. And to accommodate the vagaries of when the districts, or when the state rather, is flush with cash versus times when it's not, this policy allows the state to accommodate those needs. So what's different this year relative to last year is a couple of things. First, last year, as the testimony has already gotten into, the statute said must. So if the Commissioner of Finance at the time determined that we were about to need the cash flow borrow, the Commissioner was required to use this statute. And the statute had in it at the time a formula that was key to, and the primary difference was a $350 calculation per kid. And when you increase that calculation, you're basically allowing the school district to hit a threshold, a higher threshold, before the statute kicked in. And at the time, two things were happening. The school districts argued that the formulas hadn't been adjusted for inflation, because this has been a dormant statute since the late 80s that had never been used before. And the agency didn't feel it needed as much cash. So those two things combined to allow the $700 calculation. Subsequent to that, the legislature changed the May to must. The must to May, and then we adjusted the formula up to $700. So last year, I think the delay was about $423 million, or in that ballpark. and now we're looking at about $192 million. In terms of your direct question, what's going on between the difference between the 13 and the 35? Yep. The agency had done a lot more cash flow analysis, and I'm talking about MMB, and so they effectuated this much earlier in the year. And what you're seeing is occurring in the aid delay in on 130, the one right in the middle of the page, January 30th, is a couple of things. They had already been doing some delaying, and they had to delay before they had final data at the end of the year. So what's not shown here is the delays that had occurred up to that point. And then the difference is what remains. So that's how you get from the 13 to the 35.
Which
so
will be
the
due.
final payback is on the 30th of May, and that's when we settle up. And that's why that column's a really good one, because you can see what is actually being delayed. I hope that helps.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
So the another key to this provision in law says that it must be repaid, you know, at the end of the fiscal year in June, or the end of the year in June. And the concern about that is we've seen the cash flow projections from the past. Maybe they've gotten better, but we would still, the last time I saw them, be in the red. And so then the question is, then what happens to these school districts? Then do we go to the open market? And what is that dynamic? And so that was really the impetus for my thinking that the more prudent measure would be school districts are not the bank, and we repeal the statute.
Okay,
Madam Chair.
And Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, you know, they used to show us the language that was being repealed. Do you recall when we look at bills? And
yeah.
It doesn't show that. And I mean, I understand the issue. Mm-hmm. I would like to read the language. And I know I can go get a book or, you know, check it out. But I will do that.
Why don't you?
But I have a question about.
Show it to her right now.
I mean, I certainly understand why we want to do this, why the districts want / need us to do this. Where will this bill go from here, and does it have an impact? I mean, it must have an impact on the cash flow of the state then.
Madam Chair, I believe that it would be the Finance Committee would probably want to see this bill.
Yeah.
So for now, we may lay this over, but I would check with the Finance Committee, because they would want to examine it.
Okay, thank you.
And the issue here is it would kick in at the end of the fiscal year again, however. So they would have to pay it back by May.
Yeah.
But after the fiscal year, I think if that was, they were still in that, they could do it again. Senator Stubb?
Madam Chair, I have a couple questions. One is, is the unallotment process apply to the aid payments or not? It does to local government aid, but I'm not sure about the...
About school aids?
School aids.
Senator Nauman? Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf.
Sorry, again to you.
The unallotments would not apply to the state aids in this circumstance. What you have to have is a circumstance that triggers the allotment.
Okay.
I don't think that what you're talking about is unallotable, if you will.
Well, Senator Stumpf is asking a broader question. He's not talking about the reserve. If you were unallot, you're unallotting some appropriation. Would that not be the case? It's something that the state would be paying to the school district. Can the governor unallot from any of the payments, the aid payments going to K-12 schools?
Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, if the conditions exist where unallotment occurs, the governor could certainly go in and unallot future payments from schools.
And the assumption is with the legislation is that the state has to is basically out of cash. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Or is the unallotment process triggered by a deficit?
Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, that's actually a very good question. It's an important distinction. There is the vagaries of cash flow, which is a distinct issue from the vagaries of whether we have a shortfall in the budget. So the unallotment process is triggered in part based on budgetary balance versus what triggers this particular statute. And now it used to be triggered automatically based on the commissioner's judgment of cash flow, and now it's still the commissioner's judgment, but the commissioner, in this case, Mr. Showalter, would have to determine that this is something he would want to do, as opposed to he's no longer required to do. But the important distinction is it's a cash flow circumstance within the year where our revenues relative to the timing of expenditures, for example, versus how much total are we anticipating, and are the revenues exceeding the anticipated expenditures.
Madam Chair, the other point was that I'm wondering if this legislation wouldn't be more appropriately attached to a tax bill. And that's not a question. It's just
a rhetorical statement here. Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, members, my name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We are here to support the dynamic duo next to me who brought this bill forward. As they've reiterated, this is a month-to-month cash flow issue for school districts around the state. So even though we have the shift going on, I like to think of it from year to year, this is a piece that happens month to month and has to be repaid inside the year. I know Mr. Nauman did a nice job of explaining it to me, but he's always two levels above where I'm at. This also chooses school districts versus other local governments, whether they be cities or counties that our aid is withheld. And that's sort of a fairness issue that I'd like you to sort of think about going forward. And it really penalizes those school districts that have made conservative investments and tried to be prudent with their dollars tends to be the people who are stung by this clause. And it sort of teaches school districts not to be prudent going forward. And we think that's a little bit hypocritical, especially in times like this. So we support this bill and ask for your support going forward.
Can you tell us how many school districts, because of the taking away of they've got the $700 per pupil. How many have been put in the situation of having to short-term borrow themselves because what their fund balance was not adequate to cover their payments during this period of time?
Madam Chairman and members, I don't have an accurate date. That goes on month to month, even as we're moving here for school districts. But anecdotally, I have heard from school districts that they have to go out and borrow dollars in this area and pay interest. So it's also a question of who needs the cash flow and who should pay the interest for borrowing that cash flow. And basically, the state gets a get-out-of-jail-free card when it gets to paying interest payments on this money when they take it from school districts.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, I'll just tell you there are 144 school districts that are affected by this.
So, Senator Daley, that they've been affected, that they have give up the money, but we don't know exactly how many of them have been forced into short-term borrowing because of that.
That is correct.
Even at a given time, any time during that period, if you ever could find that out, it could be interesting.
Madam Chair, we'll follow up on
and
that.
And what other strategies as the process goes forward? I think Senator Nelson, did you? We have one more bill that we'd like to get to. So,
okay, this is just very brief. I just want to make sure I understand. There is no interest paid back to the school districts, even if they've had to borrow money. So they could be hit from losing on investments, plus they could be hit if they're in the other case where they had to borrow money on paying for interest because the state delayed their payments. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that's clear. All right, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think, Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to ask. I have two questions. Is there any other place that we do this? I understand we're talking about, education, local district budgets right now, but do we do this in any other place? Do we adjust payments to local governments or anything else where we delay?
Well, Senator Scheid, what was interesting about this, it was put in statute so long ago, I think most people didn't even know it was there because it had never been used until last year. It was discovered it was there, and it said they had to. So that's kind of what triggered the action, the attention that was given to it last year, and the change that's been made. But I know of no other. Is there? Okay. What Cook is sharing with me, they have slowed down payments to higher ed and other entities, and even payments back, I think, on tax refunds and that type of thing. So they're trying to. We have heard reviews of that, of the multiple efforts that they've been trying to use to keep from having to do short-term borrowing. So this is not the main thing that they're relying on, but it is still one. That was a tool they wanted to keep. That was why the decision was pushed that make it optional rather than mandatory last year, and then put that $700 figure in there. And I don't know if this goes on and there's pushback of the repeal, whether we have any fallback of trying to elevate it to even a higher level of protection or paying it, or at least covering interest. There's a bunch of things that are kind of circulating here in terms of the impacts on schools. What can we do that would relieve some of the negative impact on our schools that have been responsible in terms of the this isn't. There have been times when people have talked about it and school districts have been apprehensive that we start paying attention to their fund balances and taking it away from or restricting that. And we have avoided that. But I think there is some protection that needs to be provided when they are responsible, because obviously they're getting punished for having fund balance.
And Madam Chair, I understand that fully. I have a question, and it's probably for where the next committee this would go to, but I think everybody should know about it, and that is the impact of short-term borrowing and what that means for if the state has to borrow in the short term. How is that debt paid? Is it something to do with the property tax, or what is the thing? I think Mr. Nauman probably does know. Or Mr. Cook. I think there's a consequence.
Ultimately, it goes to the property tax. Constitution or something.
That's what I thought.
It seems like.
It's very scary.
Yeah. Look at it next week.
So at this point, I think I would like to lay it on the table for consideration and inclusion in the bill. Rather than send it on its own to finance, we might be better able to negotiate.
And Madam Chair, I believe Senator Scheid asked a question that Mr. Nauman was going to answer.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
Madam Chair, I thought, did I cause that to happen? I wondered if Mr. Nauman could respond.
My apologies.
Yeah,
I was
that's okay.
Distracted.
I didn't
here.
Think it was a cause and effect thing.
No,
but
no. Thank you. But I apologize, Senator Scheid.
But Mr. Nauman answer that question about
Madam
what
Chair,
happens to the state.
Senator Olson, Senator Scheid, I believe the question you were asking is, when the state takes out debt, what backs up those bonds? And all debt of the state is backed up by the total property tax, the property value of the district. So, or of the state. So theoretically, if the state did not have the resources, there's an automatic tax trigger that would impose a property tax to back up the bonds. And that's what help gives the state of Minnesota, as well as most states, or all states, I believe, lower bond ratings as a result.
Okay. Thank you.
But that's for bonds, Mr. Nauman.
Yes. Okay. That would be for debt taken out against the state.
Mm-hmm. So even cash flow borrowing?
I believe so, Madam Chair. If I'm wrong about that, I will check
that
but
out
I believe
for us.
That's the case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And Senator Bono, if you are ready, if you would just.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I would ask Dr. Weisbrand to come to the table. Madam Chair, members, I know our time is late, so we'll be very brief. Last year, when we did this shift, one of the things that was revealed is that the shift is particularly hard on districts that serve special ed populations, because when you take special ed populations, your costs are out of pocket It's a different way of paying your providers than the traditional school districts. And so Senator Saltzman carried a bill to address a school that was 100% a special ed servicing school, and we were able to exempt that school from the shift. It was then brought to my attention that Lionsgate is a charter school that serves the autism population, and that they are close to 100%, so they were almost in the exact same situation, but they had a couple exceptions to that. And so, but again, the shift in itself could be enough to close down the school. And so this is a school that I visited. It's in Senator Rest's district, and I'm very impressed with the results they're having, dealing with a very difficult and challenging population, which is completely based on serving students with autism. So with that, if you just say a few words with regard to your situation.
Well, thank you very much for inviting us here. My name is Stephen Weisbrand. I am the board chair and one of the founders of Lionsgate Academy. I brought along David Reinke. He is our business manager of the school. I thought I'd just give you a few brief words. I know the hour is getting late, about the history and the mission of the school. And if you have specific numbers, questions, we'll turn them to Dave. My daytime job is a general surgeon and a physiologist. I'm also a parent of a child living with autism. Lionsgate was started as a grassroots school by a number of us parents who thought there might be another option for older children living with autism. Our mission is to have these children, upon graduation, either getting a job, going to school, living independently, and having meaningful relationships. We are in our third year of existence. We started with 65 students. Last year we had 95 students, and this year we have about 135 students. And we still have a waiting list to get in. As you can imagine, with the shifting of the cost for the payback, it's particularly difficult for us because we are growing. So this year our payback is for 95 students, but we have 135. So we have to budget for that, and we borrow money at 7.5 to 8% from the banks to maintain our cash flow. The other challenge for us is that when we try to be flexible with it, what services we give, it's very challenging because all these children are on special ed. So if it's in the IEP, we are committed and by law to provide those services. So we don't have as much flexibility in withholding services for these children that have special ed needs as perhaps other school districts. We like to think we're more efficient than the public schools because we have the services in one spot. One speech therapist is not driving from school to school. We also like to think that we have a unique set of expertise, and so we can do a better job than the home districts. We don't want to say we're in competition with the home districts. Charter schools, you know, are about choice. And if a student is thriving in the home district, we certainly encourage them to stay in their district. The one area that you might be asking is the most difficult for us to answer is, well, how are the kids doing? Is Lionsgate meeting its mission? Are they learning more? Are we more efficient than the public schools? And that is one of our biggest challenges. These children don't test very well. They each are an IEP, so each child has a little different ruler that we gauge them by. Are they gaining their IEP goals? So a lot of what we do is we look at how the parents feel they are, and we have a very high retention rate for the parents. Anecdotal evidence, many of these children were homeschooled and now are going to school, having birthday parties, having friends, participating in school plays, music events, and we think are learning very well. But we do share that concern with you, I'm sure you all, on how is Lionsgate doing in our mission. Part of us will see later on, upon graduation, how are they doing? Are they going to college? Are they getting a job? Are they ending up in jail? Are they having a lot of pregnancies? I mean, those are the kind of data we do hope to collect in the future. So I really appreciate Senator Bonhoff helping us with this cash flow issue, because we just have a couple of students who aren't in IEPs. Some of the parents are so pleased with the performance of their children living with autism at the school, they want to send their siblings there. As a public charter school, we take everybody who comes in, and there's sibling preferences in the charter school law. So just by having one or two students, the law that was passed last year does not apply to Lionsgate Academy. That's been very challenging for us. So we really appreciate you taking the time to hear this amendment, and I'll be happy to take any questions. You have any specific numbers? We do have Dave here, who's a good number cruncher.
Madam Chair?
Senator Stump.
This is just a question of the public schools generally have, you mentioned, 7% or higher interest rate that you're paying. Public schools have a source of, I'm not sure who it's through, if it's through the School Board Association or what, but they have been getting a fairly good interest rate in whenever they borrow, and I'm not sure if you can access that or not. Do you know?
We have, Dave goes a bit, we've certainly tried to get nice interest rates for the schools. One of the challenges with charter schools is we have no really assets. We don't own the building.
Okay.
A used desk doesn't fetch a whole lot of money on the open market. So there's a challenge. Maybe, Dave, you can talk about how we got our lines of credit.
You know,
Mr. Ranke.
Dave Ranke, business manager, Lionsgate Academy.
Thank you, Mr. Ranke.
We've used one bank since Lionsgate opened, Venture Bank, and they've over the years increased the credit line, but they consider this unsecured debt. And so we've got a $500,000 credit line with them, and that's about as much unsecured as they can handle, and we're still paying 7.5% on a variable rate.
And, Madam Chair, to that point,
Senator Bonner.
That's why last year we had the tremendous work that was done with regard to changing the way that charter schools could have buildings so that they could take advantage of the school of cash availability at very good rates. And, you know, Mr. Nauman and several others worked so hours and hours devising this whole system, and it never did go anywhere. And so I don't know, Madam Chair, if you're interested in looking at that legislation this year or perhaps next year, but let's not shelve that body of work.
The other challenge that the interest comes from general ed
Dr.
funds.
Dr. Weisbrand.
I
just want to thank you for speaking rapidly because you've gotten an awful lot of information to us very quickly.
Well, thank you very much. I've been sitting through the last few hours, too, and I've noticed that everyone's getting weary. Thank you. The interest comes from general ed funds, which is more difficult for us. It doesn't really get reimbursed. So we have to find that from somewhere. We have been doing fundraising to help from that, but that is not our goal, is to have fundraising work with operations. We set up certain fiscal goals as we were going to get the school going, and we did not want to have operations come from fundraising because that just is unsustainable.
Okay, thank you. Is there further questions? Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I just had a question. With when you have 100% students that are on IEPs, you're considered a level 4, correct?
We are a general ed school. We are, as far as behaviors go, bear with me. I'm not an educator by trade, but I do know that we are a general ed school.
You are now because you have some non-special ed. That's the change in your level. You go to 1 when you have a mix all day long. It goes to 1 instead of 4, and that might be where the changing in the...
Senator Wolf, it was a legislative decision not to change the classification of the school, but if they happened to have 100%, they were very negatively affected by the payment schedule, and so we exempt them from the shift.
Okay.
This only applies to exempting from the shift. And they aren't 100% because apparently a couple siblings entered the scene, and we do have in the law requiring that you accept siblings in a family, and if they, regardless of the specialty of the school. So that's what they're asking is if we might tweak that a bit and bring it down to, was it to 90%? 90% and allow them to be spared the shift so that they might not have to cease functioning. If there are no further questions, can we we'll lay this bill on the table too for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
I certainly prefer having it to vote on right now.
Madam Chair,
yes.
If you might consider, it's fine if that's how you want to handle it. But just the uncertainty that the school is living with in terms of their day to day and the shift is affecting them right now versus waiting till goodness knows when we negotiate a final education bill. No, we hope it's May, but so I was wondering if you would consider bringing it.
She's such an optimist.
Thank you.
Senator Bonhoff, let's lay it on the table temporarily. There apparently are some drafting issues that we may want to deal with, and we won't take that time today, but let's work that through. And if it's the wish of the committee, I wouldn't have an objection to having it go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
I would alert you that we're done with committees for this week. Next week on Monday, we are having visitors from Florida. that are coming here. They have had some very successful ventures in closing achievement gap and raising student achievement, and they were willing to come and make some presentation to us. So I hope that you will be sure to come early, and we'll have a good committee meeting on Monday. So with that, the meeting is adjourned. Good.